Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:18 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is July 19th. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought I would kick off this week with gold. And it was down $20 in here today, having broken out yesterday. It has come back down to test the upper side of this short-term range. But we can also see the moving average is right there around $1,300. So the most important thing about gold is that it has failed to sustain moves above the $1,350 area on successive occasions over the last 6 years. That ended in June, and now we are in this consolidation phase. The one thing I think is most appropriate to mention about gold is it is characteristically volatile. If we go back and look at the periods where we've had failed upside breaks, they have been really the only time where we didn't get failed upside breaks and we get consolidations one above another was during the acceleration phase back in 2010. If we go back and think about everything that preceded that, there were lengthy periods of consolidation lasting about a year and a half. There were periods where it broke out and pulled back into the underlying range as well in 2010. So the one thing that we know about gold is that the time to buy it is when it has had the occasional pullback. And that generally means that you're going to have to sit with it for a while and it will underperform until it starts to outperform, because when gold goes, because it is characteristically volatile, it tends to go and go fast. That's also particularly true of silver, and silver prices were also in positive territory in here this week and gave up some of that advance in here today. Got all the way up to test the $16.50 level and has paused. But it rocketed higher earlier on this week. And I bought it too early. It went all the way down to test the $14.25 level. And since then, it has rallied. It broke back above the trend mean. It bounced from the trend mean. It broke the sequence of lower rally highs. I think the most important thing that silver has done has been to break the downtrend evidence since the peak all the way back in 2016. And I think that's one of the more meaningful events. So when we think about it in those terms, we have had a really significant change in terms of perceptions towards precious metals. And there is a pretty good reason for that. It's because we've had a very significant change in terms of the makeup of the bond market. And when we then think about it in those terms, we've had a very, I think, something that most people are now looking on as an odd situation, but seem to be still supporting it because people have been buying these bonds hand over fist. But the quantity of bonds at negative interest rates is at a new high of $13 trillion from zero in 2014. So this is a very profound change in the bond markets. It is inherently a contradiction. It's representative of the difficulty that central banks have when they're at the zero bound. What do they do in terms of trying to address the deflationary forces in the economy, or the other way around, how to stimulate the economy and try and get inflation moving again? When we look at the problems that are sitting out there, what I think is particularly interesting is the change that we've seen in the Federal Reserve. I think this is one of the most profound events that we've had in the bond markets or in the monetary policy markets, and it is perhaps behind the reason that we've had the big breakout on Wall Street. John Williams from the New York Fed. He basically said yesterday, it's better to take preventative measures than to wait for disaster to unfold. Now that's completely different to what they were saying a couple of years ago. A couple of years ago, they were talking about data dependency, and the Fed would wait and see, that they would let the data unfold and respond accordingly. They're not doing that anymore. One thing that we know for certain is that the US consumer is still firing on all cylinders, that confidence among consumers is at an all-time high, unemployment is still very low. And then we have the fact that the US economy, certainly there is a slowdown in the logistics sector, in the industrial sector, the transportation sector. Those are all, I think, reflective of global trade. The big question is, we had a massive inventory build in the third and fourth quarters of last year in advance of the tariffs being introduced in January. Now, that it probably now is contributing to the slowdown because of destocking. That having had the massive inventory build that flattered economic activity. Now, with the rundown in inventory, that is going to contribute to lower economic figures. But the balance of probabilities is that it should start to turn back upwards. And I think that's part of the reason why the Fed is now more likely than not to cut by 25 basis points. Markets have been pricing in the potential that they would cut by 50 basis points. And that was part of the reason, I think, why we've had a rather significant move in terms of the bond markets. So far, the move that we've had in the 10-year yield has been rather smaller than what we've seen over the course of this decline in yields over the last 8 or 9 months. And that remains very much the case, despite the fact that we had some pause in the advance in here today for bond prices. This has not had a very large effect on the yield. It does, though, look likely that rather than the size of the reactions, the length of time that they have tended to go for is reasonably similar. The first one was about 2.5 months, the second one was almost 2 months, and this pause has been going on for about 6 weeks. That rather suggests that we're probably in for some additional consolidation, at least for the next few weeks. But the much bigger picture is that when we look at this very long-term data, that this trend downwards is still intact. The failed break above 3% holds out the potential that we are going to see it go all the way back down and test the 1.5% level, which is the lower side of the range. And there is the potential that we will see the yield go lower. The reality is that because the Federal Reserve has changed tack, they are basically telling us that they are afraid of the next recession. That's the first conclusion, that they regard the next recession could potentially be a disaster. So, and that is just simply paraphrasing John Williams' statement. Well, that means then that they're going to do anything to try and avoid a recession, and therefore we're at the top of the interest rate cycle. The next port of call will be to try and devalue the currency. And when we think about the dollar index, well, it was in positive territory in here today and bouncing again from the region of the trend mean. I did have a question from a subscriber. I will try to answer it in more detail on Monday. But it was, why do I use the trend mean? Well, there are a number of reasons. The first is rather simple, that when we look at any market, then there does generally tend to be some evidence that other people are also looking at it. So that's one reason to pay attention to it. But it gives us a graphic representation of where the average trend is over the last year, whether prices are rising or falling. It's most particularly useful when we've had a very wide divergence. That generally tells us that the likelihood of a reversion back towards the mean has increased. And most particularly when prices roll over and then start encountering resistance in the region of the trend mean, well, then we have very clear and categorical evidence that we've had a change of trend. So we're not quite there yet with the dollar. The simple fact of the matter is that negative yields in both Europe and Japan are one of the factors in helping to support the bond market in the USA, and that will continue to be a winning trade as long as the dollar is firm. That just simply buying treasuries on an unhedged basis has been a very profitable trade from the perspective of Japanese and European investors. There have also, of course, been engaged in this momentum trade, particularly in bunds, where you have rather wide spreads because of the negative interest rates. Although Italian debt, for example, is contracting in terms of the yield rather swiftly, not least because the Minister for Finance in Italy has decided to play ball with the EU. When we think about the steadiness of the dollar index, well, part of the reason for it is because of the euro. And the Europeans just do not want a stronger currency. But when we think about the likelihood or what is driving this very narrow band that we're seeing the euro and the dollar trading at, or indeed when we think about the outlook for the Japanese yen and the reasonably tight band that it's trading in, well, it's because of the risk of competitive currency devaluation, that nobody wants a strong currency. Where we are starting to see stronger currencies against the US dollar is in the emerging markets. So, for example, the Indonesian rupiah has spent most of the week at a new recovery high. And this is a rather meaningful change here. This is support being found by the rupiah or resistance by the US dollar in the region of the trend mean. And the stock market is also standing out as being one of the better performers regionally. So, with a stronger currency, a stronger stock market, then that should generally start to create some demand for their bonds. When we start to think about it in those terms, well, there is a drive for yield out there. So if you can pick up 7% in Indonesia with the potential for capital appreciation and currency in your favor, well, then that's a rather compelling argument. That's one of the likely changes that we're starting to see in the market today, that we're starting to see because of the increasingly likely competitive devaluation that is going to emerge between the major currencies, that people are looking for stores of value. They are desperate for yield. This very clearly, I think, differentiates the motivations of traders versus investors. It is now impossible in Europe, if you want to create what would have once been a conventional bond ladder, to do so, because the whole rationale for producing a bond ladder for managing liabilities for a pension fund or for a trust is that you buy them at differing maturities, and the coupons and maturing pieces of principal will sustain the beneficiary over the medium to long term. If you're buying bonds with negative yields and have an ambition of holding them to maturity, you're guaranteed to take a capital loss. Well, that makes an absolute mess of a bond ladder strategy. So it forces investors to become more speculative. Either they have to start trading their bonds, or they have to start rolling I think, accelerating their roll schedule so that they are selling bonds well ahead of their maturity date. This is highly the correlation that we have in this kind of rationale is almost identical to what we had with credit default swaps back in 2006 and 7. With the introduction of this new asset class, there was the assumption that everybody could hedge their default, or their default exposure. But of course, we found out through the credit crisis that that's not possible, that eventually somebody has to bear the default risk, and the people left holding the bag when the music stopped were in a lot of trouble. That was most particularly true of the insurance companies, particularly AIG, for example. So now we're in a position where there are pension funds have loaded up on these bonds. They have substituted their coupon payment for capital appreciation and momentum. It's not difficult to predict that anyone holding these bonds, when the music does stop, is going to take a very significant haircut. So that is obviously where there is clear bubble risk when you've got $13 trillion of assets that have got a guaranteed total return that is negative, and people are still buying them. Well, then we know that there is a massive contradiction in this market. And that's the most important thing about bubbles. The contradiction identified can persist. It can go on for much longer than anyone would have thought possible. It goes on for so long that people accept the contradiction as normal, and it is generally at that point that things really do start to change. We're just not there yet. So there is the strong likelihood, I feel, that we're going to see some recovery in the outlook for emerging market currencies. The Asia Dollar Index has got an incremental sequence of higher reaction lows, and it is now back above its trend mean. Well, part of the reason that it has been steady is because the renminbi has been steady over the last while, but I don't believe that the renminbi is going to be the currency to beat in the Asian region. China has got a slowing economy. That is really a very significant challenge. Now, when we think about what is going on in terms of the Chinese economy, and I've got a couple of graphics that I want to bring out. They're running a fiscal deficit in the region of 5% of GDP. This is huge for the second largest economy in the world, that they're running such an enormous fiscal deficit at a time when there is not a recession. Of course, that also helps to highlight just how acute the slowdown in China is. China is a major exporter. I'm posting an excerpt from a book about China and the political environment in China in here today, which I found particularly interesting. But what it is basically concluding is there is no meeting of minds between the USA and China. That the USA has increasingly come up to the conclusion that China needs to be dealt with today, because if they wait any longer, it will be too large and too powerful to deal with. China has concluded that the USA is out to get it, and that certainly feeds into the internal struggle of communist regimes, where there is always a constant threat to the authority, whether it is real or assumed, that is always the reality. But the bigger picture is we have to think about how the last Cold War ended, and it ended with economic collapse in Russia, or in the USSR. If that is the objective of the trade war, then there is not much hope that it's going to end soon. There is the additional, I think, rather important point. As long as the stock market remains steady to firm, and the Federal Reserve is worried about the outlook for global growth and is willing to cut rates in anticipation of deteriorating economic activity in an effort to forestall it, then the Trump administration doesn't have much incentive to deal, because the base is animated, and the people who have lost their jobs, the people who have been the victims of globalization, those that it was basically the entire bet that by bringing China into the fold of the World Trade Organization and then subsequently not enforcing rules that stopped it from being protectionist, that was all predicated on the assumption that when growth picked up, when GDP per capita crossed to the magic $3,500 level, that liberalism, respect for governance, and fair dealing would suddenly manifest itself. Because that's what's happened in lots of other countries previously. That has not worked in China. But what it did represent was to place that bet was collateralized with millions of jobs. And when we think about the hollowing out of the manufacturing sector and the widening gap between the rich and the poor, then it is the absence of manufacturing jobs is the really big missing link here. It was manufacturing was the primary avenue for less educated people to attain a middle-class lifestyle. Manufacturing does tend to be more volatile. You tend to lose jobs during recessions. You tend to get them back even faster when the economy starts to improve again. But with the advent of China into the WTO in 2001, manufacturing has subsequently not been recovering, but you lose more jobs during the recessions, so that the net effect is that year on year and cycle on cycle, there are fewer and fewer people employed in the manufacturing sector. And that is one of the primary reasons for why you have this widening gap, because the jobs that have replaced the manufacturing jobs are generally in the low-end services sector, and they pay less. They pay considerably less than manufacturing. One of the primary benefits of manufacturing work is that it does tend to pay better, simply because it is more volatile. Those people are now voting to change the status quo. That is the primary reason, I believe, behind the rise in populism. And that represents a very significant challenge for China, considering it was the primary beneficiary of the of globalization and the creation of a global logistics network. Now, when we look at the Chinese stock market, well, it has been rather volatile, but it was in positive territory in here today. Now, the reality is that China is going to try and defend the 3,000 level, because it would really look bad if the stock market were reflecting the weakness in the economy. The potential for a weaker dollar and lower interest rates should be beneficial for Hong Kong shares because of the dollar peg. But China is a much more risky place than it used to be, for the simple fact that governance is deteriorating. And governance really is where it's all resting. One thing, though, that we also have to pay attention to, particularly in an environment where we have negative interest rates, is that monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time. Well, we've already seen that China is running this massive fiscal deficit, so that is positive. Then we have to consider that one of the reasons why we've had a slowdown in growth was because of the size of the Fed's balance sheet. They have been contracting it over the course of the last 18 months. And that process of contraction is going to end in September. Then, when we think about the size of the ECB's balance sheet, well, we have there got the only other example of a central bank that tried to unwind its quantitative easing. So, back in 2012, the ECB tried to unwind its quantitative easing. They took €1 trillion out of circulation, and what they got was deflation. The Federal Reserve's efforts so far have been relatively modest by comparison, particularly relative to the size of its balance sheet. And they are now going to end the process because they're afraid of deflation. So we also, therefore, have additional fuel for the potential for additional monetary easing. Because the last time the we well when the federal excuse me when the ECB took €1 trillion out, they had to put back in four, 2.5 to just get back to zero. The Federal Reserve, having contracted its balance sheet, may have to engage in quantitative easing again. So there is also the real fear in the Federal Reserve, is quite clear that when they have historically been cutting rates from the peak of the interest rate cycle, they've generally cut by about 500 basis points. And they're currently only at 2.5. So by the time the next recession does roll around, then they would be going sharply into negative territory. And that means that the quantity of bonds on negative yields could balloon from where it is today. Well, when you start to think about that potential, then investors are going to want to have assets that cannot simply be printed into existence. Well, gold is certainly one of those. And the breakout that we've had in gold, I believe, is really quite meaningful. It suggests that people are indeed looking for a hedge against the real potential for even more extraordinary monetary policy to be implemented when growth does eventually turn around. In the meantime, we know that there is liquidity starting to come back into the global market. And I'm going to see if I can. Whoops, I need to put it in this ticker. And I think perhaps I need. Yes. I have had to create my own login on Bloomberg. I've had to share all the CIXs that I created in David's login with myself. But I now have them all. The most important thing that we've seen happen over the course of the last 2 months has been that the total assets of central banks have popped on the upside and confirmed support around the 9.2 trillion level. If the dollar starts to depreciate, particularly versus the euro, the yen, and I think less likely against the renminbi, then this measure will start to increase. If the Federal Reserve starts to re-increase the size of its balance sheet, this measure of liquidity will improve. And I think that's one of the most important things to monitor. So when we think about monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time, the things we have to monitor are China's willingness to continue to run massive fiscal deficits to support its economy. And if that were to change, then that would raise the potential for a Chinese recession, which would quickly morph into a global recession. So that's something that we very much have to pay attention to. Then we have to look at the size of the various central bank balance sheets, and there is the likelihood that they're going to start to trend higher from here. And then the question about the dollar. Well, I really think that it is likely the dollar is going to be weakening from here, that the next step in terms of the competitive devaluation of currencies is for the USA to no longer tolerate having one of the strongest currencies in the world. And we're already starting to see that emerging markets are doing better. Therefore, it's emerging markets are going to be one hedge. Gold is obviously another hedge. But then, of course, we have the stock market itself. And the S&P 500 is in the region of its all-time peaks. Now, I think that considering most investors have been pricing in a 50 basis point cut, and it is more likely that we're going to get a 25 basis point cut, then we're probably going to see some consolidation. What I find particularly interesting about the market today is that the margin for error is quite narrow. Having broken on the upside, then this index should hold the region of the trend mean on a pullback. If it fails in the region of the trend mean, then we would really have to be talking about the potential for top formation development and potentially even completion. So this is a rather interesting time. The one thing that I think is possible is we do get some consolidation, but the weakness that we've had on the Nasdaq today, countermanding the move that we had yesterday, it does suggest that we are going to get some consolidation and that we could get some pulling back into the range, and I think that's quite possible. The shares to pay particular attention to, in my view, are Amazon, because it has been the buy the dips share over the course of the last decade. It is pausing in the region of its peak around the 2000 level, and there is scope here for some additional consolidation. What we are definitely seeing is that some of the most highly levered companies are starting to encounter resistance. And Netflix was down an additional $10 in here today. This is a very large downward dynamic. It is now breaking below the trend mean, and there is a meaningful drop in subscriber growth. Are we at peak Netflix? I think that has to be the question now. And if it is not going to be capable of growing any longer, well, then there is absolutely no reason to justify the PE of more than 100. Tesla is another highly levered company, and it has been rallying over the course of the last few weeks, and it was up in additional territory in here today. It is pushing back above the psychological $250 area. It has broken the sequence of lower rally highs, and it is quickly unwinding the overextension relative to the trend mean. And they are, I think, people are, I think, looking for optionality in terms of the potential for game-changing technology moves. I think there are perhaps two very big points that have to be made in this regard. There are really only two companies that are trying to develop autonomous vehicles. And the range of forecasts for when they will be delivered ranges anything from a few months to decades. So there is massive optionality in terms of what the potential outcome is. The first company that can deliver an autonomous vehicle is going to get a massive first user, or I guess a first mover advantage. Well, Tesla is touting the capability of its $6,000 suite of cameras on its cars that it will be fully autonomous in city driving by the end of this year. Now, the company has got a long history of missing these very ambitious forecasts, but it does generally tend to deliver upon them eventually. So that's the bullish case. The bearish case is they're going to run out of money before they can achieve it. And if that's the case, then, the optionality is zero. The price could go down very, very significantly. So that is, I think, one of the rather interesting cases here, because it's either going to go to zero or it's going to do rather well. And then, of course, Google is the other company that is developing autonomous vehicles. Of course, Waymo has got no value in terms of the company's balance sheet today because they don't have a product in the market. But if they are the first company to develop an autonomous vehicle, and Google in particular is only talking about developing an autonomous taxi service, they're not in the business of selling cars. They will simply want to take the place of Uber and hundreds of billions of dollars in revenue if they can deliver these kinds of services. Well, that could represent a doubling of the share, or if of course the bearish point is that they have benefited enormously from the freedom of the internet and the absence from litigation of for just about all online venues. And now they are facing greater litigation. They're facing the potential for regulation, and that has contributed to the loss of momentum. So we have, I think, what are really quite balanced views, because this range has persisted for a year and a half. This tells us that supply and demand have come back into balance. And the optionality is quite clear, because the share is currently at $1,100. Well, it will clearly look wrong if it falls below $1,000 on a sustained basis. The most important point here is that it is right in the region of the trend mean. And if it fails here, well, then it will have encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean, and that would be bearish. So that would also, I think, really highlight the fact that this had previously been among the most consistent trends in the world, and now it is less consistent than it was before. Then when I think about that, but these are massive pieces of optionality on the promise of technological innovation. Then when we think about what is it that could drive the secular bull market, what is the bull case? Well, it's simply that technology tends to move on its own cycle. It's not especially influenced by the financial cycle, although the private equity sector is heavily influenced by the monetary environment, and there has been money floating around for the last 10 years that has been able to fund investment in just about everything. Autonomous vehicles is certainly an exciting thing that's sitting out there. Then I think we also have the fact that fusion technology is closer than people thought 10 years ago. For the longest time, everyone thought that fusion technology was 50 years away, then it was 20 years away. Well, now they're talking about it being less than 5 years away. And Lockheed Martin's Skunk Works are talking about having the prototype for their new design, compact fusion reactor, being ready by the end of this year. The first time that we see net energy being produced from or net positive energy being produced from a fusion reactor, then that is likely to have a catalytic event or effect on global markets, because we haven't had a very significant change in terms of the net energy equation in decades. One of the issues with the rationale behind the majority of renewable energies is that the net energy that they produce is not as convincing, it's not as prolific as fossil fuels. And that is one of the reasons for the rather slow take-up. Doesn't mean that they won't be taken up eventually, but it does mean that the rationale for investing in the additional infrastructure relative to the payout in the absence of very clear and sustained regulatory changes to support the industry is not as strong. And that's something that doesn't tend to get talked about a lot. One of the potential solutions would be a massive innovation in terms of battery technology, but that is rather difficult, and the pace with which energy density in batteries tends to double is in the order of about 4.5 to 5 years. So that is generally quite a bit slower than anyone is really willing to tolerate. It's also, however, one of the reasons why nickel prices had been rallying rather impressively over the course of the last few weeks. Now, it was in negative territory in here today, with the dollar strengthening and some consolidation going on in risk assets. Generally, there is scope here for some consolidation. The most important thing about nickel, though, is that it has held the sequence of higher reaction lows over the course of the last 3.5 years. That is supportive of the view that demand for nickel is improving because of the rollout of electric vehicles. Every single one of the major car manufacturers has got a line of electric vehicles coming to the market within the next year. And range anxiety is going to be one of the primary discussions that a lot of people have with regard to their, or I guess regarding take-up of electric vehicles. 8-to-1-to-1 battery ratios are an answer to that. It's one of the reasons why Tesla's vehicles generally do tend to go further on a charge than other companies, because they've already implemented that chemistry in their cars. We need to continue to see innovation in battery technology if we're going to see further rollouts of electric vehicles. The other point, of course, is that natural gas prices are really very low. And when we think about just basic economics 101, the lower prices go, the greater the use case is. That when the price of a vital commodity goes down a lot, then people figure out new ways to use it. And the evolution of the hydrogen fuel cell market is very much dependent on natural gas prices staying low, because of the natural gas is the primary source of new hydrogen. When we look at the quantity of gas that gets flared off, well, it has been increasing rather sharply over the last few years in Texas because they simply don't have the infrastructure. And that's one of the challenges that we have in the energy sector today, that because prices are low, there isn't the clear economic rationale for building the infrastructure. So that is contributing to more carbon emissions. That's one of the other reasons why, or I think that's another clear example of the emotionality and the attempt to completely reshape the global economy rather than to take more common sense approaches that are easily achievable. Building more natural gas pipeline infrastructure would certainly stop more of the gas being flared off, and that would reduce carbon emissions, and it would also help the economy. It would also create new use cases for natural gas, which would cut into demand for coal and potentially even gasoline. So these are absolute no-brainers in terms of the potential use cases and the benefits. It's just that there isn't much appetite for it because the discussions tend to be so emotional. Then, of course, you have the continued demand for coal right across the Asian continent. And that has been trending higher despite the fact that coal use has been declining in the USA. But even here, Whitehaven Coal, for example, has now broken its uptrend and it's in fact trending downwards because of the slowdown in demand from China. So this is obviously another change that we're seeing here, that it is highly, or it's companies that are highly leveraged to global growth are those that are experiencing the most trouble right now. The rather sharp pullback that we had following earnings on CSX this week was also representative of some of the challenges that the I guess the best way to think about it is that the companies that are moving stuff around are experiencing. Microsoft, on the other hand, has been among the best performers of the large caps over the course of the last while, but even here there is scope for some consolidation. Having pushed on to a new high intraday, it gave up most of the advance. I think that it is more likely than not that we are going to get some consolidation in here. But it also helps to highlight that the better performers are those that have adopted the subscription business model. Part of the rationale for adopting a subscription business model is simple. It's that you're going to get a smoothing out of cash flows. A lot of companies have come to the conclusion that because of lower wages, because of the hollowing out of the middle class, that people simply do not have the financial wherewithal to pay for the upfront cost of the new product. And that by breaking it down into bite-sized chunks, they have a better potential to hold on to customers. And that is effectively what Microsoft did. And as a result, they're making more from the bite-sized chunks than they were from trying to sell the software as an upfront cost. Well, this change in terms of the way that companies are viewed, because if we look at the long-term history of Microsoft, it was very lumpy in terms of the stock market performance and in terms of cash flows. I think acceptance of a subscription business model has smoothed out those cash flows. It has turned the cash flows into the kind of reliable flow that you get from the consumer staples sector. So you still get the margins and growth of technology with the reliability of cash flows from companies like Coca-Cola or McDonald's. And it is, I think, worth pointing out the commonality that we have between these two kinds of companies, that they have been among those that have been surging on the upside. And the one common factor between them is the reliability of their cash flows. Visa is another example of a company that has got very strong, reliable cash flows, and also at a world-beating dividend payout growth rate, which was like 23% in the last year. The evolution of a new business model is rather characteristic of secular bull markets. So, in this bull market, the subscription business model is a very clear and present example of where relative strength is coming from. That's also I think one of the temptations is to say, well, these are highly defensive companies. Certainly, when we think about consumer staples, that is true. I think, though, that the advances in terms of the business model for technology companies and their adoption of the subscription business model it would be a mistake to regard that as defensive, but rather that they've just simply tapped into an avenue for growth that was not previously realizable. What is, I think, more important in terms of monitoring the return to performance of highly defensive sectors, then it's the rebound in tobacco shares. British American Tobacco, Altria, and Philip Morris International, they've all broken out or broken their at least challenging sequences of lower rally highs over the course of the last week. And that's, I think, a rather important point, that the return to performance of a sector that is generally vilified by investors, that people don't want to be seen to be owning tobacco companies. But they'll do it because of the reliability of the cash flows and because of the yield that can be captured as a result of doing it. And the only time that they flock to these kinds of shares is when they're really worried about everything else. So this is an important sector to monitor, because if it really does start to do better, then that is going to be representative of a change in terms of risk appetite. And I think that would be something that is particularly worth monitoring. I think we are in a secular bull market. I think that we are at a point where there is some questioning of that. I think the most important thing to remember is when we think about secular bull markets, well, we do have tools that we can use to monitor them. That in terms of medium-term trends, then the 200-day moving average generally does represent areas of support. But when we then go ahead and think about the secular bull market, well, then we need to look at longer periods. Now, if we look at the 200-week moving average, then we see where the market tends to find support on the big moves. And that was definitely the case over the course of the last decade, but it was also a significant factor during the last bull market. It wasn't really until we started to see the market really pick up pace all the way back between 1994 and 2000 that it diverged from the 1,000-day moving average on a sustained basis. That was the beginning of the bubble phase, and the wider the extension relative to the 1,000-day moving average, the greater the bubble case. Now, there is the potential that if we are going to get a massive move in terms of the fiscal and monetary environments, that we are going to get a bubbly phase before we get the next recession. There is the potential that we are at the trough in global growth, and that there is, with all of this additional monetary support coming through, that growth will pick up, and that would support the bubble hypothesis, particularly in view of the fact that the Federal Reserve is no longer data dependent, but they're trying to predict the data. And more than any other factor, I believe that is the big change that we've seen in the last while, and that it has the potential to drive the advance. The other point that I think is particularly relevant over the next 18 months is that we're in the second half of the third year of the US presidential cycle. Usually, in the first half of the third year, you get a growth scare, and we've had that. It's in the second half that you start to see the Federal Reserve easing policy and the party in power beginning to prime the pump for the next election. And that does appear to be happening right on schedule. In terms of stock market performance, we generally do expect to see the best performance of the 4-year cycle in the latter 18 months of it. And that suggests that while there is short-term risk of some consolidation on stock markets, and particularly for shares that have become really very overextended relative to their trend means, that the medium-term outlook is that we will see these breakouts extended later on this year and into next year. And the good thing about monitoring the stock market at the current levels is if the breakout fails and we start to see the lows put in June taken out, well, then we would have an additional trend in consistency. Then we would have to start to change or to question the conclusions I've just laid out. And that's not all that far away from where prices are right now. So again, this is another example of an almost polarized market. There is a small margin of error, and that the potential for upside or indeed downside is rather magnified. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.